Whoa.
Just lift it. Lift it more. Lift it more. Lift it more. Stop. Which way does it go? So we'll talk a little bit about what spirit is considered to be from the perspective of the Vedic literature, the literature of yoga. When we, of course, spirit is a word, an English word. The Sanskrit word is atma. And atma can mean different things, but in the context that we're aiming at here, it means the consciousness within the body. Every one of us has experienced that we're a combination of body and mind, or body and consciousness. And the two are distinct. I say my body, I don't say I body. And with my consciousness, I direct my body. I tell the hand, now you raise, now you go down. I feel what's going on in my body. If you pinch me, then it's not exactly the body that feels it. It's I that feel it. If your mind is elsewhere, who here has gotten a paper cut sometimes? Yeah, you've all gotten a paper cut. Maybe you might have the experience sometimes that you're doing something with paper, and when you finish whatever it is that you're doing, you realize that you had a paper cut. Has that happened to you? So that means that you didn't experience that paper cut because your mind was elsewhere. And then when your mind didn't have anything to do, oh, I couldn't accept that paper cut. Ouch. So the experience is not done exactly like by the body, like the eyes. We say, I saw it with my eyes, or you say, my eyes saw it. But your eyes alone don't see anything. There's all this information processing that goes on. And then you say, I see it. It's not that my eye sees it. The eye just, well, does all that mechanical stuff. It focuses the beam of light and throws it onto the retina. And there's rods and cones, and they send little electrical pulses into through the optic nerve and goes into a particular part of the brain. Without the optic nerve and all of that, your eye wouldn't see anything. So the eye is just a machine, a mechanical part. And the Vedic literature says that even the brain is another mechanical part. It's sophisticated, the most sophisticated part. It's the information processing department of the machinery of the body. But above the brain, is consciousness itself. The brain itself is not innately conscious. It processes information coming in through here and there. But the Vedic literature says it's not in the flesh and bones of the body that consciousness is actually found. It's resonant within the body, but it's separate from the body. In the body, but it's not the body. Just as you may be in a car, but you're not the car. Or you may be on your, I'm online, but it's not exactly that you're on the line, but you're connected to the keyboard and the screen and all of that. So the Vedic aphorism is that I'm not this body. I'm not this mind. I'm a consciousness within the body. Right? That consciousness is identical with what's meant in the Vedic literature by spirit. Spirit and consciousness, you could say, are the same. Of course, we go unconscious, but still consciousness is there. It's just coming. Okay. So that consciousness is always there from childhood to youth to old age. Your body changes. Childhood body and old person's body are not the same. But consciousness is the same. I remember that I was a child. I remember when I was young. The same I is there, but the body has changed. So that I is the consciousness. I see there are like so many departments I was seeing on the way over here, botany and oceanography and physics and the usual departments, but there's no department to understand what is the difference between a living body and a dead body. Within the living body there's consciousness, and what is that consciousness? That's the actual self. According to the Bhagavad Gita, maybe you've heard the name of Bhagavad Gita. According to the Bhagavad Gita, that consciousness has no point of creation. And it has no point of destruction. Najayate Rintepa. It's not created. It's not destroyed. It exists. Just as there are things which are temporary, like this table, like this microphone, like this body, there are things that are permanent. Or there's one thing that's permanent, and that's consciousness. You can't cut it. You can't burn it. You can't dry it out, you can't blow it away. There's nothing you can do materially to destroy it. You can't crumple it, you can't squish it, you can't drown it. It's always existing. Temporary practically implies that there's something that's permanent also. And that permanent feature, that permanent thing, is the actual self, and that's what we mean by spirit. The spirit is the same, or it's of the same nature in every body in which it's found. You have consciousness, I have consciousness, the child has consciousness, the old man has consciousness. And we experience that consciousness, the consciousness that I have as a child, although the content may differ, the experience of consciousness is the same. You pinch me when I'm a kid, or you pinch me when I'm older, and the same conscious perception is there. And unless we're perfect solipsists, we think that other people have a similar experience, that if you pinch yourself, you'll feel pretty much what I feel when I pinch myself. Because you're like me, you're a conscious being, I'm a conscious being. The difference between the living being and a dead body and a living body is that consciousness is present in the living body. And the dead body consciousness is left. Not only the human beings have consciousness, but the trees, the animals, the birds, the fish. They have consciousness, they have feelings. They have perceptions. They have some kind of thought. They have some kind of desire. They want to fly or they want to swim. There's a difference between a living fish and a dead fish, a living dog and a dead dog. It's the same difference. You immediately see that this dog is conscious or this dog is dead. So the spirit within, or consciousness within, all living beings is of the same nature. And the bodies are different. This is the platform of actual equality. There's no such thing as material equality. Men are different from women. Old people are different from young people. Tall people are different from short ones. Athletes are different from skinny guys like me. Bodies are different. You can't make them all the same. Some of us are brilliant, some of us are slow, some of us are strong, some of us are weak, according to the particular body we've got. But spiritually, there's absolute equality. Spiritually, there's absolute equality. It doesn't matter what the body is. Even the lower species of life, they're equally spirits. They're just trapped in a very restrictive body. The tree can't go anywhere. Nor do the animals inquire, why am I here? What is my purpose in life? Because their body is more restrictive. It doesn't give such broad options. So spirituality means to identify myself, first of all, as spirit, as that consciousness within the body, and to see others also as spiritual living beings, all of the same quality, all of the same nature. Okay, somebody's cell phones. You might want to check your cell phones, by the way. I'm sure there is. They're silent as hers now. Yeah, it's okay. You can reach for your cell phone if you'd like to turn it on. That's fine. Then one might ask, where spirit comes from? And science says, well, spirit or consciousness, they say spirit, they say consciousness comes from mature development of matter, sophisticated, is a sophisticated epiphenomenon of matter. And they say that, but they can't show that. No one has ever created consciousness in a laboratory. Stanley Miller, notwithstanding, no one has ever. For that matter, if we're asking where consciousness comes from, we might also ask where matter comes from. All around us, tons of it. Universe is full of it. Well, where does that come from? Someone said it comes from a black hole. Where does the black hole come from? Go on and on like that. The Vedic literature says that there's an origin of everything. The Vedanta philosophy begins by asking, what's the origin of everything? Well, there must be some source from which everything comes. That's the assumption. And then the question will be, should that source be unconscious, like the chair or the microphone, or conscious, like you and me? Because we have these two categories, consciousness and non-conscious entities. And the Vedic literature says the source of everything should be conscious, because the development of everything requires intelligence. The universe shows every sign of intelligence. Things are going on. Even if you think of any material thing, think of a car, think of a computer, think of an engine, think of a dam, think of anything that works. It works because there's intelligence behind it. Without intelligence, machines don't go. So if you look at the universe as gigantic machinery, then the question would be, well, whose intelligence is running the machinery? What's the intelligence behind it? By that line of thought, we arrive at the conclusion that the origin of everything is the supreme consciousness. It's not my consciousness. There are people who meditate like that. I am moving the sun. The moon is shining by my power. And they go deep into meditation, but it's madness. If I, you know, while I'm meditating, if someone knocks me off, the moon will keep shining, the planets will keep going. So it's a delusion that I know. I'm conscious, and there's a supreme consciousness, but I'm not that consciousness. Just as you're all South African, yes. Unless there are any visiting students, you're all South African. And the president is South African. So there's no difference between you and the president, because you're South African as he is. But that doesn't make you president. He's the chief South African, and you are the subordinate, smaller to South Africans. So the Vedic literature gives this philosophy of spiritual understanding, of spirituality, that there's a supreme consciousness, and then there are parts of that supreme consciousness, which is all of us. And spirituality, or yoga, is the process of reestablishing the connection between the two. At the present moment, I've turned away from the supreme Krishna, we say, Sanskrit language, turned away from Krishna, and I'm turning toward matter, or maya, that which exists only temporarily. And yoga means turning back toward Krishna, back toward the supreme, back toward that supreme consciousness. That's nutshell spirituality, core spirituality. Then there are different ways to do that. You've probably heard of the yoga system where people sit in a certain way, meditate and close their eyes and breathe in a certain way. Yeah. Well, that's one system of yoga. It's called Ashtanga Yoga. That system of yoga was practiced in a previous millennium, actually thousands and thousands and thousands of years ago. And people used to meditate for thousands of years. They had longer lifetimes, we learned from the Vedic literature. They could sit and meditate literally for a thousand years. They were so accomplished. They could withdraw their consciousness from everything else and be totally absorbed in meditation for a thousand years or more. They would go off to a sacred place, off in the forest, in the bank of the Ganges, up in the mountains, and meditate and attain perfection. That's not much of a modern option. We're not going to do that. We're not going to go off to the Himalayas and meditate for a thousand years. Even if we thought, oh no, okay, but then the rest of the rules, you have to be in certain posture, you have to observe strict celibacy, you have to actually drill your respiration until it stops, until you brought it into such a state of equilibrium that you don't breathe anymore. Don't think we're going to do that. Maybe we'll do some postures and exercises and lose some weight, feel really good. But we're not going to do those other things, which are the things that you really have to do if you're going to follow that program for spiritual realization. That belonged to a previous age. In the modern age, the Vedic literature recommends meditation through sound. Previous ages, it could be silent meditation. Intense concentration. In the present age, that intense concentration by just sustaining willpower is no longer possible. But meditation by sound is very easy. As soon as there's a sound, can I get a sound here, please? No. That was better. As soon as there's a sound, your attention goes to it, doesn't it? You know, if there were window were to crash or something, and you'd be startled with when your phone rings and everybody sees the phone ringing. The sound is powerful. Sound attracts our attention. So in the modern age, we can take advantage of that by hearing transcendental sound. Transcendental sound, we've heard this term mantras, I think. Everyone has heard mantras become a common English term. Mantra is a kind of transcendental sound. It's a sound, mantra. Actually, mana means mind, and tra means delivering. So a mantra is meant to deliver our mind from the mundane level, the material level of preoccupation, and bring it to the spiritual level. It does that because the sound itself is said to be coming from the spiritual platform. Because on the spiritual platform, sound and substance are the same. This is a theoretical discussion, but actually by chanting mantras, we experience that actually the sound and what the sound designates are equal. Here there's a difference. If I say Coca-Cola, 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 I'm still thirsty. Maybe more thirsty. Because the name and the drink are different. But on the spiritual platform, the name and what is the name of are the same. There's no material distinction. And therefore, by hearing or chanting these transcendental sounds or mantra, we can just at once come to the spiritual platform without having to go through a speculative process or any other means, just by focusing your mind on the transcendental sound. One comes to the spiritual platform. And that's the theory, that's the idea given in the Vedic literature. But one can experience that by chanting and hearing of transcendental sound and very quickly make progress in the present age. In previous ages, other methods. In this age, this method. The mantras generally or ideally consist of names of the Supreme, names of God. You may have heard the Maha Mantra, have you? Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. And three names there. Krishna means all attractive, because the Supreme must be all attractive. If something is more attractive than the Supreme, well, that's got to be Supreme. So Supreme means, by definition, all attractive. That's what Krishna means. And Rama means the reservoir of pleasure. If there's a greater pleasure someplace else, then that's got to be Supreme. So Rama and Krishna address the Supreme, and Hare is the spiritual energy of the Supreme. Just as you get the sun and the sunshine, you get the Supreme of God and God's spiritual energy. And the mantra is put together in a way that pulls your attention and doesn't. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare Rama, Hare Rama. It captures the mind, which is what we want. Doesn't mean you become mindless or you can't think anymore or machinery doesn't work. But it means that you're able to focus very easily without having to do all the postures and meditation and stopping your breathing. Just by chanting, you can fix your mind, and that will purify the mind, that will elevate the mind for spiritual understanding, spiritual realization, and one can actually experience it by chanting. There are many other names of the Supreme, and there are other, one can chant any one of them, hear any one of them, or one can take advantage of this Mahamantra as an easy and suitable means for the present age, for spiritual understanding, spiritual understanding. That's a quick synopsis, perhaps. And yeah. Do you have time for questions? See if anyone. He's going to give you a microphone. That's going to make life easier.
I'll just start by asking a question. If the body and conscious are two different things, then how is it that if we live a healthy life by eating the right food for the body, we also help the conscious?
Body and mind are two different things. How is it that?
Like, if we live a healthy life by eating proper food to help the body, how do we also help our conscious in that process?
If you eat proper foods, healthy foods, then you feel different, don't you? So the question is, how is it that there's this connection between the two? Yeah, something like you're riding in your car, and when the car is a really good car and it's well-tuned and it's moving down the road very nicely, you really feel good. And when your car is a 1952 Chevrolet with broken this and broken that, and it's just kind of chugging down the road, making you might feel pretty shook up, pretty bad. But you're the same person, right? It's not that you've gone from being a Chevrolet person, from being a Ferrari person, to being a Chevrolet person, being a BMW person, to being a Chevrolet person, or being a 2010 person, to being a 1952 person. It's just the machine that you're in. And because you're in that machine, you feel you're affected by the environment, by the machinery that you're in. So naturally, if we eat an unhealthy, stuff yourself, practically kill yourself kind of life, our consciousness is going to go down accordingly. And if we eat healthy, moderate, sensible, pure kind of diet, then our consciousness will be elevated. So the yogis do that. They regulate their eating. They eat in a pure and simple fashion, not too much, not too little. And other people, they leave it to other people to eat stuff that's too hot, too sweet, too this, too that, or rotten and stale and so on. So we're affected by what we eat or by the environment around us. But there's a difference between us. I say, I feel full. Means I feel that my, when you translate it, I feel that the machinery is all filled up. But it's not you that's full. Just like if you put petrol in your tank, when it's filled up, you say, I have a full tank. But it's not you that's full. It's your machine. So the body is connected, but it's not myself. Yes, in the back.
You said that it's a self-entity of the spirit and it's the mind of the body.
I think you have a loud voice, and I might hear you better without this. This is a very echoey sort of thing. No, but you have to speak loud. You have the mind and the body. Not being loud enough, I can't. Do you want to try again with the microphone or just speak louder?
Okay, you said that there's the mind and the body, and then you have the spirit. Mind and body,
and then spirit, right.
I'm a practicing Buddhist.
You're a practicing Buddhist, okay.
Obviously, we don't believe that there is a spirit.
You don't believe in?
That there is a spirit.
You don't believe that there's a spirit.
You believe in dependent origination.
You believe in?
Dependent origination.
Dependent origination, right. There's desire that gives rise to clinging and so on.
Yes, definitely.
But I have a question. This is the Buddhist theory. In Buddhism, as this student is saying, there's no spirit really. And in fact, consciousness is, in one sense, illusory. Consciousness can ultimately be dismantled because what you have is a process of dependent origination. And I've forgotten the sequence now, but there's desire which leads to clinging, or perception which leads to desire which leads to clinging, and so on.
Yes.
So a question that one has to ask on those under those circumstances. Apart from, of course, we might ask exactly how that happens, but that's a technical question. The larger question is why it's set up that way. If there's only either matter, or if there's only the illusion of existence, what we see and what we think exists doesn't really exist at all. It exists only because of my perception of it. And my perception of it is dependent on the illusory existence of myself. Because self is really a sort of a concocted thing. There is no real self. We have to ask ourselves where that comes from. If there's this complex system of dependent origination, in which one thing leads to another, leads to another, leads to another, and cyclically goes around like that, where does that come from?
Emptiness.
Excuse me?
Emptiness.
From emptiness. Well, then one has to ask what kind of emptiness this is that's so sophisticated that it gives rise to this very complex variety. From the bank, you'll get a 5 rand note, a 10 rand note, a 100 rand note, 500 rand note, I guess, maybe 1,000, I don't know the currency so well. You'll get all these different kinds of notes, and one will be green, and one will be pink, and one will be, I guess. Because they're all there in the bank. Now, imagine that the bank, you know, when you creak open those giant doors to the bank and look inside, it's empty. Now, how from that empty bank would you get 5 rand notes and 10 rand notes and 20 rand notes and green ones and pink ones and so on? So the question that one has to answer, if everything comes from emptiness, how from emptiness do you get this variety? And that's a very difficult question, as far as I've seen.
But I think the mind of emptiness is not actually emptiness.
It's not actually emptiness.
It's paradoxical.
It's paradoxical.
It's
emptiness.
Beginninglessness.
It's beginningless.
It's
beginningless. Let's look.
It's ambiguous.
It's what?
It's ambiguous. It also begins.
It's ambiguous.
But we refer to it as emptiness.
It's ambiguous, but we refer to it as emptiness. Okay, so now it's not emptiness anymore. Emptiness is out of the picture. There's something ambiguous. But if we study what that ambiguous, whatever it is, must be, it must be a very sophisticated ambiguous entity, because so many varieties are coming from that, whatever, from that ambiguous source. So that source, just like we see a mountain, let's say Table Mountain on a cloudy day, is a very ambiguous thing. It's, you know, Zen-like, cloudy shape. Right? That's Table Mountain on a cloudy day. But, and that's where maybe Table Mountain from many miles away. But as we get closer to Table Mountain, or as the cloud cover starts to recede, we start to see some varieties there. There's redder parts and greener parts. And if we went right up to Table Mountain, or the clouds totally blew off, we'd see trees, we'd see rock formations, we'd see, I guess there's some rivers up there. We'd see, I saw there was some building up there. We'd see variety. The same thing that appears to be cloudy and ambiguous from a distance, as we move in on it, turns out to be full of variety. So the Vedic angle of vision, or the Vedic understanding, is that when we come to the source of everything, it's not empty, nor homogeneous, you know, just a sort of a spiritual homogenized milk, but that it's the source of all variety, and therefore all variety must be potentially present there. And as consciousness is one of those varied manifestations, consciousness must also be present in that source. So then you get a source which is conscious, and when we say conscious, immediately spirit is there. When we say, you can knock out the word conscious spirit if you want, but there's what we experience, that I have feelings, perceptions, desires, thoughts. And these are characteristics of consciousness or spirit. So when you come to the source of everything, these must be there. That's vague. Emptiness doesn't really work. And ambiguous is ambiguous. When you take, in one sense, knowledge is the process of taking the ambiguous and understanding it in detail. Yeah, this college was ambiguous until I got here, and now I have, well, there's all these distinguished men who taught here, or had something to do with it, and there's this woman and these students. Otherwise, it's just the University of Cape Town, some ambiguous thing. Now that I'm here, it has particularity. So the Vedic approach is to take the ambiguous and the absolute, which is the sport of everything, is very ambiguous, and move in on this until we get a clear understanding. Thank you for the question. Yes?
I just want to understand. You said that, we're all conscious, and so are animals. So I just want you to tell us, what draws the line between consciousness and sentience?
What draws the line between consciousness and sentience? Is that
no, it's just like feeling, because we can all feel something, mm-hmm. but it doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, like there should be a difference.
Let's see, I said that we're all conscious beings.
Yes, and then you said that animals as well.
And I said animals as well.
Yes, they're also conscious.
They're also conscious, yes.
What draws the
line between the type of consciousness we have and the kind of consciousness they have?
Yeah, because there should be a difference.
Excuse me? There should be a difference, huh?
Yeah.
We can look at it this way. First we'd say, there's no difference. I feel, you know, when you feel unhappy, and I feel unhappy, or when a dog feels unhappy, it's the same feeling, you know? So you've seen a dog cry? Seen a dog cry? I've seen an animal cry. It has, you know, as you feel, it feels. You see an animal happy, jumping up and down, really happy. So we feel that. They feel that. They have some desire for something. They desire to eat, they desire to sleep, they desire to mate, they desire to live. We have that. We have thoughts. Animals have thoughts. You keep some milk on your table, and the cat wants it, but the cat thinks, if I jump up now, she's going to chase me away. I'm going to wait till she leaves the kitchen, then I'm going to jump up, and then I'll get the milk. So they're thinking also. But because of the body, it's restricted. Why take an animal? Take a child. Children don't attend a physics class around here, even though they're conscious as much as all the students are. But because of the body that they have, because they have an undeveloped, less developed body, their consciousness doesn't extend to the same extent as yours and mine. Or take a person, take a human being who's mentally retarded. They have consciousness and you have consciousness. But because of the equipment, we say the equipment is defective. There's something happened to the brain at the time while the child was in gestation. There was an accident when the child was 3 years old where he was deprived of oxygen. Something happened. The body was damaged. And so the consciousness is restricted. Just the same thing. I'm in a little motor scooter or a moped. I can go along at a certain speed. And then I get into a Ferrari and I can go at a different speed. Because the equipment is different. And I'll feel the difference. When I press on that accelerator on the Ferrari, it's a different experience than the moped. Right? Yes, it is. So this is due to different bodies. But the perception, if you look at what we say consciousness is the person who perceives. I see a bone, and the dog sees a bone. And the dog thinks one thing about it, and I think another thing about it. But the fact of perceiving is the same.
But you can't really say animals is a ritual.
I can't say that animals
spiritual.
Are
spiritual.
Are spiritual? Why can't I say that?
It just doesn't make sense.
Why doesn't it make sense? Compare the animals to us. The animal eats, you eat. You sleep, the animal sleeps. You have a family, the animal has a family. You love your family, the animal loves its family. You feel pain, the animal feels pain. You feel pleasure, the animal feels pleasure. You think about certain things, the animal thinks about certain things. You want to live, the animal wants to live. Now, why do we say now that, yes, but I'm spiritual and the animal's not spiritual? When there's so many points of similarity in regard to consciousness. These are all functions of consciousness, thinking, feeling, desire. There's a difference between me when I'm alive and me when I'm dead. My body when I'm alive, my body when I'm dead. It's the same for the animal. Why do you say, no, we're spiritual, they're not spiritual? Our group is the spiritual group. Their group is the group that has no spiritual existence. Why? On what grounds? If they're grounds, okay, but why? They have different bodies. We walk on two legs, they walk on four, but they don't have any legs. Fish. But that's not grounds. But the body is different. The body may restrict the expression of consciousness or the extent to which consciousness can gather information. If my brain is damaged, the extent to which I'll be able to communicate with the outside world may be different. But I'm the same person. Even when I'm asleep, you can't say, well, he was spiritual 10 minutes ago when he was awake. Now he's sleeping, so he's not spirit anymore. So the Bhagavad Gita says that the self-realized person sees all living beings as spiritual. The dog, the human being, the elephant, the tree, all living beings. Okay. Make a little more sense?
Yeah.
Good. You had a question?
Yes. I just wanted to know, do you believe in the superiority of consciousness?
Do I believe in?
The
superiority of consciousness. Superiority to matter?
No, superiority to
The
hierarchy of consciousness.
Hierarchy. Yeah, is there a hierarchy of consciousness? Okay, let me think about that for a second. Yes. Even in... Yes, there is, because my consciousness is not all-extensive.
Did you say any consciousness can be
all-extensive? Yes. If you look at, let's take something. With my consciousness, I build a little sandcastle. And with the consciousness of a big developer, I develop, you know, a housing development or an office development or a city. So consciousness is more, has greater scope. It's more extensive. But even here, there's gradation experience. But when you look at a universal construction site, that requires superior consciousness. That's not to be done by you and me. And you get into, even if you look within yourself, you'll find that you get inspiration sometimes. You're working on a math problem and you just don't get it. And then while you're taking lunch, all of a sudden the solution comes to you.
Maybe that's consciousness.
I mean to say that if you think about that, your consciousness is getting inspiration from a superior source.
So is intelligence consciousness?
Yeah. Consciousness is always intelligent.
It's not a function of the mind.
Oh, but no, is intelligence consciousness? Is that your question? No. Intelligence is... Okay, I'll take apart some terminology for you. The Vedic literature gets very particular about it. We just say, well, there's mind and there's body, right? But mind, body, and spirit. The Vedic literature analyzes a little more closely. It says, well, there's the body, the physical machine, and then there's mind, and it defines mind as the subtle part of us that accepts something and rejects something. You know, you're going by a window and you say, gee, I like that dress. No, actually, I don't. Well, actually, it's pretty nice, but... You go back and forth. That's the mind. I think I'd like to go to Durban. Nah, why waste the money? Well, it'd be kind of nice. Nah. That's the mind. Accepting and rejecting. Okay. And I'm off stage. And intelligence is the analytical capability that focuses the mind. Mind is going back and forth, back and forth. Then I analyze it and say, that dress costs 300 rand. And I don't know the currency enough to know whether that's expensive or cheap. But we look at it and say, well, it's 300 rand. And on the other hand, you know, this is the only dress I have, and it's about to be finished. And we analyze it all. I could get it cheaper down the street or whatever it is. And at the end of the day, we say, okay, I'm buying. Or I'm not buying. According to what our intelligence has concluded. And then it's no more. It's now, I've made an intelligent decision. So the intelligence is, you could say, the higher part of the mind, or is higher than the mind. Then you analyze further and say, yeah, who's using that intelligence? Let's use our intelligence here. The implication is that I'm separate from the intelligence, or that intelligence is a tool at my disposal. And that's the Vedic way of looking at it. The consciousness itself uses intelligence, but is more subtle, is more... Yeah, it's higher than, you can say, intelligence, because it's the conscious force that makes use of intelligence. If you look at it this way, someone's very intelligent, that is equipped with a lot of intelligent power, and somebody's slow, he doesn't really have it. But within both of them, there's a conscious being. The animals don't have a whole lot of intelligence. They have, you know, cat was pretty smart there, but not that smart. Wouldn't solve a physics problem. But the fact of a conscious living being who's using intelligence is the same.
But would you say that someone who is able to build a chair and someone who is able to build a skyscraper, that's a gift of intelligence and not consciousness?
It's a gift of intelligence.
And not consciousness.
Consciousness is the same in both.
Of course it is. But then it's a gift of intelligence that allows them to build a chair.
A gift of intelligence. Yeah. Someone is just like this physical body is a gift. Some of us have strong, beautiful, healthy ones. Some of us have weak, ugly, diseased ones. So that it's a gift, either kind of a crummy gift or a good one. Same thing for intelligence. Some of us have lots of it, smart, quick, supple, and some of us are sort of not very well endowed. When they were giving out intelligence, you know, we were at the end of the line. But again, it's a gift. Now, a gift to whom?
Then you're going to say that if consciousness is relevant,
if consciousness isn't relevant,
and intelligence is.
No, I'm not saying that at all.
But that's what, if everyone has a consciousness, mm-hmm. and consciousness is present in all of this.
Yes.
Between everyone here, there's no superior consciousness in this room.
No one is superior but in consciousness.
But in intelligence, someone might be able to build a chair in this room,
right.
Someone might be able to build a skyscraper.
Right.
So it's intelligence that allows us to build something and not consciousness.
Exactly.
We're all at the same present consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no such thing as a superior consciousness.
Yes and no. The superior and inferior for intelligence. Yeah, you can say that, well, consciousness is the same in all of us, so then you can't judge superiority or inferiority by intelligence, because intelligence is just a gift that's given to all of us who are equal. Then you have to ask who's giving the gift. So again, you wind up with a being which is superior to us. If I'm on the receiving end and someone's on the giving end, then the giving end must have something that I don't, must have greater capability than I do. So that, again, we come to a superior entity.
Is the being collective consciousness? Or
is it collective? No. Because you put us together, and let's try it theory that individually none of us could say put together a universe, but collectively perhaps. But we don't have that experience that collectively we're somehow or other making nature work. That I don't really know it, but without my knowledge somehow an interior part of my consciousness is participating in making the universe work. And all together, maybe my own hidden aspect of consciousness is not realizing it or doesn't pull it off on its own, but collectively if you pool it all. But there's no indication of that. It doesn't correspond to anything that our experience. There's no real reason to buy into that point of view, except that there are a lot of us. Since there are a lot of us and we're all conscious, we can posit that, well, maybe all of us together, all of our consciousness pooled in some sort of unconscious network is making the universe go. But there's really no indication of that. There's no evidence for that. And it would be hard to imagine how, without knowing it, I'm pulling off such a sophisticated thing, even collectively. Like if we were to collectively say, we're going to build a new student union, student building. Maybe 20 of us would get together and we pool our intelligence and we say, well, this, that, well, that's a good idea, let's add this, let's not do that. But unconsciously, how we might all pool our intelligence, that's nothing within the range of experience or there's nothing to indicate that. Rather, what's in our experience is that a smart architect builds a really terrific building, an architect with less capability builds a lesser building, 20 of the super architects get together and consciously focus, and they build the ultra fantastic building. But collective consciousness, collective unconscious consciousness, doesn't quite work.
Consciousness isn't a material thing.
Correct.
So then it goes beyond the material things that happen on this planet.
True.
So if it goes beyond material things that happen on this planet, it must be an ethical quality.
It must have an ephemeral quality.
Ethical or spiritual quality. In other words, it's not present.
Mm-hmm.
It's omnipresent.
Mm-hmm.
It's present in everything.
Well, if you have spirit present in everything, yeah, okay, spirit is beyond material limitations.
Yeah.
But then we need to look and see what it is. That it's beyond limitations doesn't mean material limitations, doesn't mean it has no characteristics. It has spiritual characteristics. Now, let's look at myself as spirit. In my experience, I experience my body. When I'm full, I eat, I'm full, I feel it. When you eat, I don't feel full. Because your consciousness is present within your body. Isn't it? I mean, I don't experience it. I have no idea what you're thinking.
If she helps her, because she's got a broken leg,
right.
I'm sitting there and I see that I feel fulfilled as better as a human being to see that happen. There's something in me that goes. It's not a physical thing.
But it's different from what happens to her.
Of course.
If somebody helps her leg, she feels, oh my God, I was in such enormous pain, and now I can at least think again. When you look at it to see that now she's out of pain, you feel, wow, I really sympathize. It looks like she's better. But it's not the same as what she's experiencing. Because you're in that body, and she's in that body. So you can empathize, you can sympathize, you can hypothesize about how she might be feeling now that her leg is so much better. But you don't have the experience that she's having. Because her consciousness is within her body, and your consciousness is within hers. That indicates an individuality to consciousness. So consciousness is, in one sense, beyond material. But it has its own spiritual characteristics, and one of them is individuality. Yeah.
I'm wondering about spirituality or whatever. Does it exist only in living bodies, or can it exist in non-living or dead bodies? So,
yeah, good question.
So does a person who's dead still have spirit or not?
Yeah, good question. Is spirituality present in living beings or in non-living beings also? The quick answer is in living beings. That in one sense, the presence of spirit is the difference between a living being and a non-living being. So, for instance, you're a living being, so spirituality is there, consciousness is there. The microphone is a non-living being. It has no consciousness. The table has no consciousness.
And if a living being passes away, then...
And a living being, that means, while the body is there, but the consciousness is no longer there.
Wouldn't it be the other way? Wouldn't it be that... wouldn't it just mean that the body itself is not working anymore?
Yes.
But the consciousness could still be there, or...
Could still be there.
Well, that's what I'm asking. Does the consciousness still exist when the body ceases to?
Yeah, the consciousness still exists, but it leaves.
Okay.
It leaves. We say, now there's no more consciousness in the body. We can't detect any sign of consciousness.
So then what happens to our consciousness?
It goes to the next destination, the next path. Just as you went from child's body, now you're in a young man's body. You'll go to an old man's body. When the old man's body is finished, go to a new body. And consciousness is never destroyed. But it moves from one body to the next. How are we doing on time?
Thank you, sir.
One thing is, that thing is terrible.
Yeah.
Tina's read book. Yes.